solitary confinement in Florida prisons. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a new report on the practice of solitary confinement in Florida prisons says Florida's rates are off the charts and that it's torture and should be ended. What do you think? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later in the hour, why the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wants you to help them with rebuilding projects across Florida and in the Caribbean in the wake of massive storms. Plus, a vision for art. We'll tell you about a five-day exhibit here in the city of Jacksonville. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, it's a new report on the practice of solitary confinement in the Sunshine State. The Southern Poverty Law Center says the Florida Department of Corrections holds approximately 10,000 people, that's more than 10% of its prison population, in solitary on any given day. To put that number in perspective, the national average is about 4.5%. This report, called Solitary Confinement, Inhumane, Ineffective, and Wasteful, examines the growing consensus that solitary provides little to no benefit for correctional institutions and may in fact be harming the mental health of those subjected to it, going so far to say that it's virtually a form of torture. The organization is calling for an end to the practice of solitary confinement here in Florida. We're taking a closer look this morning as we welcome Shalani Goyal Agarwal. She's senior supervising attorney for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Also with us, Phyllis Johnson Mabry. Her son died by suicide while in solitary confinement in a California prison. Ladies, thanks so much to both of you for being with us on the show this morning. We appreciate you being with us.
Thanks for having us.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about solitary confinement, your questions about its effects on inmates in Florida prisons and how the Florida Department of Corrections uses solitary? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. We're already getting your calls about this. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open too. In a moment, Phyllis, I want to ask you about your son who died by suicide in solitary. First, though, let me begin with you, Shalani. Tell me about this report from the SPLC looking at the practice of solitary confinement here in Florida. What did your study find?
Well, we tried to take a look and see what the impacts of solitary were in the prisons, and we were pretty alarmed by what we found. So to just start off with basic definitions, we think of solitary as a practice of keeping people confined to their cells for 22 to 24 hours a day. And when confined in their cells, people rarely have contact with others. And there are really well-documented harmful effects of this practice on people's mental health. Even people who were perfectly mentally healthy before being placed in solitary, including an elevated risk of suicide. International sources, the UN deems solitary for more than 15 days to be torture. And in Florida prisons, routinely folks are being held for much, much longer periods than that.
And why is Florida using this practice of solitary confinement at a higher rate than other states?
Yeah, I mean, the rates are alarming. You cited the statistics at the beginning. To put it in context, we're so out of step with the rest of the country that one out of every seven people who are in solitary in a prison in the United States are held in solitary in Florida, which is just, we are an outlier. I think that there's a couple of reasons I think maybe correctional officials think that this is the way to go. One is that there's a, very potentially like just a assumption that folks need to be punished. but what we found in our study was that folks were being put in solitary for really just not seemingly insubstantial reasons, refusing to follow an order, refusing to failing to make their bed or clean their room at a certain time, resulting in kind of extended periods of solitary. So I think it is maybe a convenient behavior modification tool. I think that prison officials sometimes think of it that way. But the, it's it's devastating for the individuals. And what we found is that it also can be really problematic for the prisons. When folks have been in solitary for a long time, there's usually increased assaults on staff. People become more violent, more mentally damaged. And also when folks are released from prison, ultimately, they are more likely to commit crime if they've spent time in solitary. It's counterintuitive, I think, to some prison officials, but the practice is not achieving the behavior modification that they're seeking.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about new data on the use of solitary confinement in Florida's prisons. Phyllis Johnson Mabry, you're on the line from Orlando. Your yes. son, Michael, died by suicide last year, and I'm so sorry to hear that. He was being held in solitary confinement at the Santa Rosa Correctional Institution. That's in California. Tell me about your son.
He was 25 when he went in. He was a brother, a son, a father of one. He went in. The first thing he did was get his GED, and he scored so high, he got another special certificate and was looking forward to taking, college courses. He never denied that he should be in jail for what he did, but he always said in his letters that he can't believe that he's being treated the way he's being treated, that he didn't understand. He was in solitary confinement for 6.5 years. On the 5-year mark is when he mentally broke.
What happened at that point?
Hallucinations. Shared that he was hearing voices in his cell. No human contact. We weren't able to do calls because the prepaid phone that they had when you're in solitary confinement had broken. And they just kept saying they were going to get another one. Well, a year passed. So that's a year of no phone calls with your family. There were times he didn't write for months. I called to find out what's going on. They said, he can write. There's no reason why, you're not getting a letter from him. To find out, he didn't have a writing utensil. He didn't have a pen or a pencil for 2.5 months.
And what was the reason that they, was the reason they were holding him for years in solitary confinement? What was their justification for that?
When he first went, I forget the location, prison, Florida State Prison. And he had been there for a while, I would say maybe 2 years or so, and had a confrontation with an inmate. He'd been trying to avoid it for a week and a half. And he says, Ma, if this guy approaches me again, he says, I have to do something or I have to worry about all the inmates in this building. So we talked about, can you speak to someone? Can you make it, aware to the COs? And then you have to worry about being marked as a snitch, a rat. So you're stuck in a hard place.
And so you said at the 5-year mark, you feel like your son mentally broke.
Oh, I know. I lost a son that I have raised and known. He was paranoid. He was not trusting. He was losing hope in the end. Just looking at the four walls, he's like, I'm treated like an animal. I never hurt anyone. I never stole from anyone. He didn't understand the treatment for the crime.
Why he was incarcerated?
He was incarcerated for hitting a police officer. He wasn't out there looking for him. I'm not justifying it, but he was home. He had been drinking. It was the weekend. And the music was loud. Neighbors called the police. The police stated they heard a woman screaming. That could have been his girlfriend or her mom. Always screamers. And the officer came in the house, and Michael swung at him.
I see.
And in Florida, you swing at a law enforcement, there's a minimum of 15 years, the LEO law. So at 15 years, at 25, we're looking at 40. He would have been when he got out, without gang time.
But he died by suicide after 5-6 years incarcerated. Is that right?
Nine and a half years. Yeah, okay. But he was in CM for 6.5.
Okay. And so
no visits. Every time we called, no, can't have visits. No, he can't have visits. So now you don't see your family. You don't get to talk to them on the phone and hear their voices. You don't get to write and get correspondence. It's awful. You're disconnected.
I'm so sorry to hear your story, Phyllis. And I think it really helps people understand how this practice affects not just inmates, but also their loved ones.
It's horrible, CM. If I had to describe it, I would describe it as cruel, barbaric, and inhumane. We don't treat pets like this. When you hear something at a pet place, ASPCA, the news is there, everybody's picketing. But what's happening in CM, they're breaking people mentally. And what happens when those that do survive it get released? There's no rehabilitation. Either we're on disability or they're doing something to go back.
So, Shalani, with Southern Poverty Law Center, this is one story of one family that illustrates what your study is showing, which is that solitary confinement practices have demonstrably resulted in a high number of inmates committing suicide. Can you explain why that happens so often with people who are put in solitary for extended periods of time?
I think the research shows that folks are not meant to be deprived of human contact entirely. Mm-hmm. You know, that people may think of that as a behavior modification tool, but it really it has the capacity to really damage a person. I'm not saying this does this uniformly across the board, but for folks with certain who have pre-existing mental illnesses, or folks, you know, some, like I mentioned, some folks just have that damage occur once they are in that condition of solitary for an extended period. All kinds of different depression, anxiety, you know, there's a lot of self-mutilation, you know, different kinds of behavior associated with mental illness are exacerbated just by that extended period of time that folks are in a cell by themselves without any human contact.
Now, your report states that in the late 1990s, the Florida Department of Corrections was sued by a class of incarcerated people over solitary confinement practices. That resulted in a settlement and some reforms. It did not end the practice, though. With the publication of this report, is it your hope to pressure Florida's Department of Corrections to end this practice?
Yes. I mean, we're hoping to expose what's going on so that the broader public is aware. I think that sometimes when folks go to prison, you know, people, it's just kind of out of sight, out of mind, and in solitary, even more so. So the goal is for people to understand what the state, in the name of Floridians, is doing to folks who are incarcerated. And, you know, to think for themselves whether this is an effective way for us to punish people. You know, knowing that folks will be eventually returning from prison at some point, like, do we really want them to be so damaged that they're unable to function in normal society? Do we really want to make the prisons more violent than they would otherwise be by virtue of putting people in solitary?
And so, what's your response to corrections officers who say they use this practice sometimes to protect an inmate and sometimes to punish an inmate?
Yeah, so, I mean, there are different kinds of solitary, right? I think that Phyllis just referred to CM, which is called close management, which is typically an extended form of solitary confinement when the prison system fails, like the person is unable to conduct themselves for an extended period in the general population because they're a threat to themselves or they're a threat to others. And then there's also a couple of other kinds of solitary confinement, maximum management. There's also disciplinary confinement, which is supposed to be more short-term. And administrative confinement. Administrative confinement is supposed to be also for a shorter period until you transfer someone to one of the other kinds of confinement. What you're talking about in terms of protecting an individual, that's called protective management, which is a fifth kind. So we have a whole bunch of different kinds of restrictive confinement in the
Fourth Circuit. Okay. And let's go to some calls now as we look at the new statistics out this week on the use of solitary confinement in Florida prisons. Not jails, prisons. What are your questions, comments? 549-2937. Victoria is on the line from New York. Hey, Victoria. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, I just have a couple statements. First, they are not only in solitary confinement. They are in solitary confinement in 150 degrees at times. Where you can't even breathe. They are in solitary confinement where it's up to the officers to flush the toilets, all the toilets, at the same time, where they will leave the toilet unflushed for days, that they have to sit in 140 degrees smelling that feces and urine. They are mentally tortured in there.
And Victoria, do you have a loved one that endured this? It sounds like you know a lot about this.
Yes, I do. And that's only the beginning of it. I can write a book. You can call, and the only response you will get is to call another number and another number. And there is no help, and there is nobody that will hear you. Then upon release, they are released into society with no transition after spending 5, 6, 7 years in solitary confinement into a society that now they are mentally ill. Where they come out, they are institutionalized. They cannot socialize because they have had no human touch. They will cut themselves in solitary confinement, become cutters, just to get out, to talk to a nurse, to talk to somebody. They will mutilate themselves just to come out for even a couple hours to speak to someone. Then when they're released with no transition at all, they cannot deal with society. Now they are mentally unstable.
Did that happen
to
you?
They are angry.
Did that happen to your child, Victoria?
That happens. That they will come out and make sure they will do everything in their power to go back because they are now institutionalized and can no longer function in society.
Victoria, I can hear the pain in your voice. I can hear how upsetting this has been for your family. And I
will go to the extreme to kill someone to go back for the rest of their life because they know they cannot make it in society. They have taken away every self-worth.
And who did this happen to that you know and you care about?
A family member.
I'm so sorry, Victoria. I'm so sorry. And I feel so much what you've been through. I can hear it in your voice. And I thank you so much for that call. I hope everybody heard Victoria. She's calling from New York, by the way, talking about this. And so thank you for that, Victoria.
Yeah,
thank you for that.
That was as well the solitary in Santa Rosa.
Okay. Thank you for that. And I didn't mean to cut you off. I just want to make sure we don't lose Phyllis, who's also here on the line.
Here.
Phyllis, so that her story sounds somewhat similar to your story when you were sharing
about your son. It's painful because my son never had mental health issues. Going through paperwork and reports I got from the prisons and medical examiner's office, they labeled him antisocial. Well, how can you be social if you're in CM for 6.5 years? Now he's supposed to, respond to commands and do things. He's not functioning. He's mentally broken.
And Shalani, what about the caller just now saying that when people come out of the system after this many years in solitary, they find ways to get back in because they feel that they can't function in society?
Yeah, I mean, we saw that with a number of people that we encountered who were in solitary in Florida prisons that, after a time, it almost becomes a like a crutch that that they are unable to function, and that's how extremely isolated folks are.
Tweets from listeners. Here's one from Brian. Solitary is damaging. A 2009 essay in the New Yorker noted, EEG studies going back to the 1960s have shown diffuse slowing of brain waves in prisoners after a week or more of solitary confinement. So it actually changes the brain functioning. Is that right, Shalani? It changes the way the brain operates.
Yes. Actually, you know, we found that especially with young people who are still developing, and it's amazing. In Florida, they don't really distinguish between folks with mental illness, folks with young people, folks with disability. All people in all those categories end up in solitary without any regard to those risk factors. And for young people, it's especially devastating because of their brain development.
Yeah, their brains are still developing. Let's go to John in Jacksonville. John, you're on the air.
Hello. I had a client. He was 18. He was in for a misdemeanor. I believe it was criminal mischief. And he wound up getting MRSA on his rear end. And so he called me. I went and looked. And when he pulled his pants down to show me where it was, they decided he should be disciplined. And he was like 18. They gave him like 45 days was what they gave him.
I'm sorry, what was the offense?
Criminal mischief. That's like breaking something.
Okay, so he got over a month in solitary for criminal mischief. Is that right?
No, he got that for pulling his pants down.
Pulling his pants down. I see. Okay. Okay. And what happened to your client?
He had a MRSA infection is why. So then I wrote about the MRSA and so forth, a letter to the sheriff, and so they put him in, they call it the medical wing, and he was the only one in there. And of course they forgot to give him a towel and a blanket, and it was very cold, and it was the one without a functioning water fountain. So just by chance, I'm sure. So they literally tortured the kid. So, and that was local.
And that happened at what institution, John?
I'd rather not say it this time, but it was local.
Okay. And so do you feel that your client suffered mental damage?
You know, he was 18. I can't say he suffered mental damage per se, but I know he was tortured. And it just seems like that was their plan. So.
All right. Thanks for that call, John. Thank you for that. Shalani, let me ask you as a follow-up to this, getting tweets letting us know that a bill was introduced in the legislature this spring session to end solitary confinement, but it didn't go anywhere. It's essentially dead for this session. I'm sure someone will try again. At the same time, I need to ask you about other issues involving your organization, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Morris Dees, who led the organization, resigned after some turmoil at the SPLC and criticism levied at the organization. So as you release this study, what is your response to those who might seek to discredit its findings, given that there has been some controversy about the organization, the Southern Poverty Law Center, as an entity?
Well, I guess I would just say that I hope that our work speaks for itself. And this, you know, the firing of Morris Dees, I think there was a statement that our organization made that it was related to misconduct. And, you know, this study is, I hope, speaks for itself in terms of looking at what the real problems are that exist in our prison system and what's being done in Floridian's name.
And we're talking about the new report, Solitary Confinement, Inhumane, Effective, and Wasteful, examining the use of the practice in Florida prisons. Let's go back to Phyllis Johnson Mabry. Phyllis, this report certainly is the latest in a long line of studies and revelations about Florida's correctional system and just a series of accusations that have been leveled against the Department of Corrections here in this state about the way the incarcerated are treated. What would you say to those who don't have a problem with very difficult or even inhumane facilities? They are more of the mind that if you commit a crime and you're incarcerated, that you deserve what you get. What's your response to those constituents out there that hold that view?
I agree with if you do the crime, you know, you deserve the time. That's our laws, and we're to abide by them. And if we didn't, we would have mayhem and a free-for-all in this world. But we don't treat terrorists this way when captured. We don't treat prisoners of war that are captured this way inhumanely. I mean, illegals come over. They're breaking the law. It's the treatment. I could see CM being used as a tool temporarily for violent or, you know, a threat to themselves or other inmates and staff. But to be used indefinitely to where you break a person psychologically and mentally, that they're no longer able to function. My son had problems even speaking when we did have phone calls because he was highly medicated. He couldn't even tell me what medication he was taking. He signed paperwork through HIPAA in the prison for me to get information. To this day, I will never know what it was they were giving him. Did the medication trigger suicide? For a person that loved life, I can't see him killing himself after serving 9.5 years and having 18 months to go. It's cruel. It's inhuman. I'm not saying, you know, that everyone, you know, you could break the law and you're not going to pay for your, the consequences of your actions and choices. But torture? This isn't a third world country. You hear that overseas. You hear that on world news. That's not the government and what the USA is. And what's happening behind those walls in CM is cruel and inhuman. And someone needs to do something and ban it. It destroys not only the inmates, but the families and society for those that come out.
So Shalani,
I knew I was going to have a broken son come back. But we were prepared to do whatever we needed to do as a family to get him the support and help he needed. I never thought that he wouldn't be coming home. His last letter speaks about coming home and that he learned his lesson. He'll never go back to a prison again. And I think that part of rehabilitation took place, but it was too late. The mind was broke. He was separated from family, calls, letters, everything, and left alone. I couldn't function like that. I don't think any human can function that way with no contact.
Shalani, that's certainly what the data shows in this report, that the removing of all human contact is so damaging to human beings that it is considered by a growing number of prison reform advocates and mental health professionals as cruel and inhumane. And so now with the release of this report, do you expect more legal action here in Florida against the Department of Corrections to try to end this practice?
I think we're going to have to, I think that what the report shows is, yes, you're right, that it's cruel, it's inhumane. As to legal action, you know, I think that the problems are manifest and we'll just sort of have to see where it goes from here. But, you know, I would add to in addition to, you know, the damage it does to individuals, the solitary confinement, to folks who say, oh, well, you know, if you did the crime, you have to do the time. And so if the conditions are bad, you know, you deserve it, basically. It is absolutely counterproductive for the prison system to do this. It's not just like we want to punish this person, even if that's the intent, which I would maintain is, you know, is not a wrong way to think about incarceration. But even if that is the intent entirely, just we're going to punish this person, ultimately it's going to waste taxpayer money because the cost of housing people in solitary confinement are actually higher than the cost of housing people in the general population.
And we didn't get into that too much, but that is also in the report. And for those who want to read the full report, go to splcenter.org for this new study on solitary confinement in Florida. Phyllis Johnson Mabry and Shaloni Goyal Agarwal, we appreciate you both being with us this morning and sharing this with our listeners. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thank you. And up next, the Army Corps of Engineers' ongoing cleanup efforts from recent hurricanes here in Florida and why they need your help. This is First Coast Connect. Back in a moment. I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, where we talk about the biggest stories in the state.
From politics to education, the environment, and more. If it's news in Florida, we want to hear from you.
Let your voice be heard. Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at noon on WJCT.
All the music that's fit to play Monday through Saturday nights at 9, only on 89 FM WJCT, where music matters.
Welcome back. Well, hurricane damage across Florida, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands means the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is working overtime, years after the big storms have passed, to clean up the damage. And they're hiring, too. I learned more about this massive public works effort from the Corps. Take a listen.
Tim Murphy, your Deputy District Engineer for Programs, Project Management with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Also with us, Jackie Kaiser, Supplemental Program Manager. As we talk about this really extensive disaster recovery work in Florida, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, $4 billion plus in storm disaster recovery work. Tim, let's start with you. The Jacksonville District of the U.S. Army Corps and districts, honestly, around the country, it's my understanding, are looking to hire people to help with this work because it's such a big job. Can you bring us up to date on what you're working on and what your needs are?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. We have over the entire portfolio of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, we have $17 billion. $4 billion of that is actually in the Jacksonville District, but across the nation, we have $17 billion. Right now, we currently have around 36,000 employees. Every district we have is taxed to the limit. We're brokering work amongst ourselves to make sure we all stay busy. So we're definitely in a hiring mode right now then. We have an opportunity to grow, to continue to build the nation's infrastructure with the funds that have been provided.
These are government funds allowing for people to be hired, and what are the hires you're looking to fill? What types of jobs are most or workers are most needed?
Yes, ma'am. We are the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, so we're definitely looking for engineers. But we're more than engineers.
It's kind of a silly question, isn't it? Of course, that's what you're looking for.
But we definitely have more than engineers. We have accountants, we have biologists, archaeologists, engineers of all fashions, as well as biologists. I mean, it's kind of like if you say an IST at the end of it, we're looking to hire all types of scientists and engineers.
Jackie, how extensive is the damage that you're still dealing with, and what are some of the kinds of projects you're doing?
Sure. We've got about $1.1 billion for Florida recovery from the storms, and this is Harvey, Irma, and Maria storms, but Irma and Maria in Florida. And we're working generally coastal storm risk management, or also known as beach projects, navigation projects, and then we have a good deal of money for the Herbert Hoover Dyke in South Florida as well. Like I said, that's about $1.1 billion. Another $2.5 billion for major flood risk projects in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Puerto Rico still hasn't even come close to bouncing back from Hurricane Maria. Lots of Puerto Ricans listening here in our area, certainly even more in South Florida. How critical is the situation there still, and how is the Army Corps working to address it?
I was down immediately after the Hurricane Irma and Maria went through. I've seen great progress in the last year and a half. It's been painful. The folks in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands have endured enormous amounts of tragedy there. And as such, as a result of the pain that they've learned, we have $2.5 billion to put infrastructure in the ground in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. We're chomping at the bit to get at it. We have designs underway, some construction's already underway, and most of the work that we have, it's all flood control related to cover the storms that come down there. The floods are almost like flash floods. You get a small rain down there, and the flood, 30 minutes later, you have a flood. They don't have the time to develop, the time to get ready for it, because it's almost instantaneous. Mm. But I've seen great improvement in the last year and a half down there, working closely with the other federal agencies, as well as the Commonwealth or Puerto Rico agencies.
That's good to hear. And then here in North Florida, Jackie, what are some examples of projects you're working on that can better protect us if we face the kind of flooding and damage that we saw after Irma?
Sure. We have many projects in Northeast Florida. In fact, we just last month completed the Duval County Shore Protection Projects. We put about 800,000 cubic yards of sand on about 8 miles of beaches at a cost of about $18 million. And that's restoring the sand to that beach that protects the upland infrastructure and the population in those areas.
So beach renourishment is a big part of this?
Absolutely.
And that's so important to do. At the same time, I know the Army Corps, other governmental agencies are looking at the long-term impacts of rising oceans. At what point does spending money on renourishing the beaches, and I realize it's a ways off, but at what point does that become, I don't know, counterintuitive or perhaps not the best investment?
So the beauty of the beach is really its biggest downfall. Most of the beaches we all know and love are actually engineered beaches, but you wouldn't know it by looking at it. And the issue of long-term issue is essentially sand quantity, potentially cost. So we are undertaking, as part of the supplemental program, a regional South Atlantic coastal study looking at just that. What's the smartest things to do to reduce risk to storms in the face of sea level rise over the next 50 years? What are the priorities in the region? What are the plans, whether they be natural infrastructure, hard infrastructure, or even retreat from the beach?
And that study is being done now.
It is.
When do you anticipate that to be released?
That'll be released as a final in 4 years, but we're working right now a massive outreach program with stakeholders to get input as we continue to evolve our scope. The key to this study is it's not a Corps of Engineers study. It's a stakeholder collaborative study because it's not about what the Corps of Engineers can do. It's what we can all do together to reduce the risk. And that's rolling out across the state and the region. We just had our Northeast Florida meeting a few weeks ago, but we have another. It's going to be a webinar available to anybody who wants to call in. It's called the Visioning Meeting. And if anybody's interested, they can look at our Jacksonville District Corps of Engineers website. Look for the South Atlantic Coastal Studies tab, and they can see the invite to that.
Very nice. And they should also look to see if they might fit the profile of the type of person you're looking to hire. What should people know about that if they're interested in this opportunity?
Couple things. Two things. One, we have a job fair that is coming up. What's the date on that? Miss Jackie?
April 26th at the Airport Hyatt.
At the Airport Hyatt Hotel. So a job fair, anyone who might fit the qualifications for this big increase in staffing that the U.S. Army Corps is undertaking.
That's correct, ma'am. We're hiring, again, across all boards, not just engineers, but engineers and the scientists in general. We're hiring from entry grade all the way up to senior journeyman level. Anyone, pretty much any and all, are welcome to apply. We have the ability, which is pretty cool, to do direct hire, which means that if you come in with a resume and you fit our requirements list, we can offer you a job right there on the spot. And we haven't had that ability in many, many years.
So in an era of low unemployment, still, this is a really exciting opportunity, I would think, for a lot of people.
It is, but Florida in general is growing like crazy, and so there's competition for highly qualified, competent staff, and we want to be competitive as well.
Okay, anything else people need to know about this project?
Well, in terms of the opportunities, I think if you're a go-getter, there are so many exciting opportunities with the Corps. I mean, from family-friendly atmosphere to great benefits to just a fun place to work on nationally, regionally significant projects.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us. Tim Murphy and Jackie Kaiser with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers as they work on disaster recovery in Florida, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Well, she started with a simple idea, a local entrepreneur producing fried lentil snacks. Yes, fried lentils in little bags out of her home. But in 1 year, this food concept has blown up, winning national awards and getting lots of attention. In our movable feast, Lee Court speaks to Charlay Smith of Jacksonville's Lentil House.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy.
Everybody. Welcome and tell us, what is the Lentil House?
The Lentil House came about because I love everything about lentils. I started in my home with the cottage home business. It was a no-brainer.
How long ago was that?
A year ago.
So in a year, you have created this lentil business, the Lentil House, in your home, and you're winning national awards.
I think it's blowing people's minds. When they hear about the lentils, they kind of think, lentil soup. Yeah, that's always their reaction. But once they've tried them, they're like, unbelievable. I started cooking fried lentils from my mom. I learned from her. They are fried, pan fried, and I started flavoring it with the flavor that my mother taught me, and that was turmeric. And all the other flavors that came after were basically from my idea, trying to be the kid who's improved, you know, wants to do a little bit better.
What do you see in the coming year for your business? Are you going to branch out and do something other than lentils, or are you just going to just continue taking lentils to the moon?
I would love to take them to the moon.
Well, the tip of the iceberg is just the small amount of people who know about you at this time, who honor and love what you're selling and what you're creating. I'm just going to take my bag of sweet ginger baby lentils and just go hide, and I may share them. So thank you very much, Charlay Smith, the Lentil House. We're going to be watching for what you're doing next.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
On the next Fresh Air, fear and hope about climate change. Bill McKibben, who first warned of climate change 30 years ago, says its effects are now upon us, with heat waves, fires, flooding, drought, and soon millions of climate refugees. He also warns of the dangers of human genetic engineering and artificial intelligence. McKibben's new book is called Falter. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Marco Werman. Each day we cover the world beyond our borders and across our borders.
Homeland security, that's exactly what we want. There's no better term, there's no better name. Just like an American, you can't stop an American from traveling abroad. Well, you can't stop a Guatemalan or a Honduran from leaving their country as well.
America's Border, just one of the stories we follow on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
One word starts with a U, ends with a Y, and is pronounced trade war.
We're holding off on major capital investments, and we're just in sort of a holding pattern.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Uncertainty is the bottom line when you don't know your next move. Tell you more next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Roseanne Cash has been a trailblazer for many women in the music industry. Her first number one country hit came in her mid-20s, and since then her catalog has explored love, loss, family, and place. Roseanne Cash on what concerns her most about her country, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's an exciting art exhibit for 5 days only, appealing to art aficionados and casual collectors alike. It's called A Vision for Art, and it's going to be on display at St. Mark's Episcopal Day School. Here now with a preview, Michelle Calloway. She's co-founder at Space 42 and the curator of A Vision for Art. And Bibi Alexander, art instructor at St. Mark's Episcopal. Ladies, good morning to you both.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's start with you, Michelle Calloway. Space 42 over in the Cork Arts District has really established itself as a hub for art and technology and design. And so it's exciting to hear about this project that you're doing. How did this all come about?
My son actually attends St. Mark's Episcopal Day School, and Bibi came to us actually last year. We've been working on this for probably 6 to 8 months. And said, I have this really cool idea. It's a new fundraiser we want to do for the school. And you guys have the expertise as the gallery in the city. And we would love for you to help us curate it.
And these are artists curated from all over America, correct?
They're all over. Most do have ties to Jacksonville, which is really exciting. But yes, Jacksonville obviously is the majority of the artists in the show.
Okay, so admission is free to at least part of this, Bibi. Tell us about the exhibit and how you envision this supporting the school.
We have 37 artists right now, and they are going to be, each artist is showing their own body of work. We have, it'll be open Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 5.
12 to 5.
12 to 5. Monday and Tuesday from 6 to 8. And all of the work, it's 50% goes to the artist and 50% goes to the school.
Now, artists from the community were also paid to work one-on-one with your students to create work for the show, because you have art students there as well, right?
We do. We have children starting age 1 all the way through 6th grade. And each grade level, we've had an artist come in and work with students. And those pieces are going to be part of a silent auction that will be for the opening night.
This all goes to raise funds for the fine arts program and for financial aid for students who can't afford the tuition at this school, of which there are quite a few, I would guess. So it's a way to help children go to this school.
Definitely. And I think St. Mark's has such an amazing reputation. And Bibi might be able to speak to this a little bit more. I think she had mentioned to me that 1 in 4 students at St. Mark's does receive financial aid. So there is an ability for more students to attend the school and be a part of the fine arts program as well, which is a really important part of the school and one of the reasons why my son goes there.
Yes, that's correct. 1 in 4 students at St. Mark's is on financial assistance. Mm-hmm. So we're really excited to be able to, you know, add to our program.
This is 5 days only, so people need to mark their calendars now.
Definitely, and the entire community is invited. This is not just a private event for the St. Mark's family. We really want this to be an event that the community can come and enjoy and see what the local artists in Jacksonville are doing and help support the school as well as the art community as a whole.
You're having your opening night celebration Friday, April 26th, and then that weekend, open shopping hours. People can come and buy this art.
That's right. We're going to have food trucks Saturday and Sunday. So we'd love for anyone to come, but also the opening night, it's not limited to our St. Mark's community. You can get tickets online at avisionforart.com.
Avisionforart.com. Support the work of local artists, although some of them have fanned out across the country. It's the inaugural A Vision for Art at St. Mark's Episcopal Day School. That's in Ortega, avisionforart.com. And check out Space 42 as well while you're at it, because they're doing amazing things in this city. So thank you so much, Michelle Calloway of Space 42 and BB Alexander, art instructor at St. Mark's Episcopal Day School, A Vision for Art, to check that out. Thanks, ladies, for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
All right, that's our show. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And if you have feedback about anything you heard, give us a call or send us an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, the latest on the medical marijuana market in the state of Florida. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. 1A is up next. We'll be right back here at 9 a.m. Wednesday. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 p.m., just keep listening for the Electro Lounge. Have a great day.
Join WJCT and PNC Grow Up Great to celebrate Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, May 11th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the WJCT Studios. Meet Daniel Tiger, Katarina Kitty Cat, and their friends. Tour TIAA Bank Field, meet community helpers, face painters, enjoy local food trucks, arts and crafts, and so much more. Reserve your spot today for this free, family-friendly community event by visiting wjct.org. Start something good in your neighborhood.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.